Open your Bibles with me this evening to the book of Galatians. We're going to be spending most of our time there tonight. It's really good to be together this evening. Greg, it's good to have you back. What we're going to be looking at tonight is something that's a little more, I guess, of a technical topic. I prepared this sermon in preparation for a two-day study that's coming up in a few weeks. But it's a topic that I think is helpful to us. If you've ever read the book of Galatians, you can't come away without realizing that there is this glaring problem that the Christians in the churches of Galatia were facing. And it had to do with a particular type of false teacher and what they were teaching and how they were upsetting the faith of some of these Christians. And so we're going to talk tonight about who these people were, what their motives were, kind of where they came from, likely, and how Paul dealt with them. And I think that as we study this, there'll be some practical applications we can think about for ourselves as we try to guard our hearts and minds and try to fortify our own faith. So we're going to start off by looking at some of the terms in the Old Testament background and then get into the identity and teaching of these people, their motives, their methods that they use to persuade people, how Paul reacted, and then some applications and misapplications of some of the principles that we're going to look at tonight. So starting off with kind of the term Judaizing, you might not be familiar with that term. It comes from Galatians 2:14, when Paul confronted Peter and said, "How is it that you compel the Gentiles," by his hypocrisy, "to," and there's this Greek word, judaizo, I believe is how you pronounce that. And the idea is to adopt Jewish customs and rites, to imitate the Jews, to Judaize, of one who observes the ritual law of the Jews. The idea behind the Judaizing teachers is they are Jewifiers, basically. They force people to become Jews. There's a similar word in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew, in Esther 8, you remember, after kind of the tides turn, and there's a bunch of the people there in Persia who decide to declare themselves Jews, basically. So this Hebrew word from Jacinius' lexicon, to make oneself a Jew, to embrace the Jewish religion. So that's where this idea of Judaizing comes from. And what's interesting is it has its roots. I mean, why would anyone want to become a Jew? What's the biblical precedent for that? When you look at the law of Moses, the Lord had intended for his people to accept sojourners who were there among them, that they weren't just to refuse everybody, and there was not zero connection between them and the nations, but sometimes there'd be people who would come in and sojourn among them. In Deuteronomy 5:14, it refers to the sojourner who's in your gates. The King James refers to this, the proselyte of the gate, again, the one who had come into their camp. Isaiah 56 and verse 3 identifies one as being the foreigner who has joined himself to the Lord. I think the Jews reading that would have understood that to be a convert to Judaism, though I think in prophecy it means a Gentile who has accepted Christ, so there's a different sense there. A couple of notes that we could have a huge long list about the sojourners in the Old Testament. But one of the interesting things is that they weren't a full convert to Judaism in a sense that there's some different laws. If something dies of itself, the Jews were not to eat of that, but they could give it to the sojourner who was among them. So they weren't kept to the exact same laws. And they were only required to be circumcised if they desired to eat the Passover. So there were some differences in how the sojourners were treated. They weren't like a full convert. And one of the things that's interesting is in the Old Testament, we don't really see the Jews actively evangelizing the nations. They're not like going out trying to convert them. Jonah is a little bit of an exception to that, in that he is specifically sent to Nineveh. And that effort, of course, Jonah doesn't react too well to that until after the persuasion of spending 3 days in the digestive tract of a fish. So there are provisions, though, made in the law for those who want to be among the people. But there were those who became full proselytes, became full Jews. Of course, you can think about the ones that stand out in your mind. Rahab, as she ends up in the lineage of Christ, it appears that she fully converted, became a follower of the Lord. Ruth, the Moabite, as we talked about her, when she said to Naomi, "Your people will be my people and your God will be my God. I think the idea is that she is committing herself to the Lord. And of course, the way he had a relationship with people at that point in time was through the law of Moses. Uriah the Hittite would have, of course, been originally a Hittite, and then is in the service of David. And Doeg the Edomite, not a savory character, but again, someone from outside that we see within the camp of Israel. One of the interesting things, and we're just going to go through these very quickly for a moment, is in the Old Testament prophecies, there's lots of times where the prophets looked forward to a day when the nations would be brought in. And we can look at passages like Isaiah 2, and it's talking about all the nations streaming up to the mountain of the Lord. And there's phrases like, the law will go forth from Zion. In Isaiah 51 and verse 4, a law will go forth from me. I will set my justice for a light of the peoples. Zechariah 8, one of the images in Zechariah, 10 from all the nations will grasp the garment of a Jew, saying, let us go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. If you were a Jew in those times where all you know is the law of Moses, what would those passages look like to you? It would look like probably that, well, at some point in time, God is going to make all the Gentiles convert, basically. And that might have been one of the misconceptions that some of the Jews had that ended up wanting to make sure that the Gentiles are converted. No, you can't have a relationship with God without coming first through the law of Moses. So I think looking at this through the eyes of the Old Testament, you can see where some of the Jews would have gotten these ideas, whether erroneously or not. In the New Testament, we see two categories of converts to Judaism. There's the full proselyte, one who has completely converted to Judaism, like Ruth or Rahab. In Matthew 23, verse 15, in the woes to the Pharisees, it's interesting to see Jesus say, you travel land and sea to make one proselyte. So there was some kind of evangelism going on by the time we get to the first century. The Pharisees were very zealous about that. We know that there are Jews and proselytes present at the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2. Nicholas, a proselyte from Antioch, is one of the seven deacons, likely, who is appointed in Acts chapter 6. And then in Acts 13:43, some of those who respond to Paul's message at Antioch and Pisidia is the God-fearing proselytes, that there were those being converted who had been first converted to Judaism. But that kind of brings up a second category of person that we see in the New Testament. Again, we're going to go through this very quickly. Is that there were those who feared God. And there's a couple of different terms that are used. Feared God or those that reverenced God. And of course, Cornelius is one of these people. And we see that they have some desire to serve God. They don't keep all of the Jewish rites and customs. But there's a lot of references to people like this, who aren't full proselytes, but they want to serve the Lord in some capacity. And of course, Cornelius is going to be the first Gentile convert who's not forced to be circumcised, who's not forced to keep the law of Moses with all of the signs that accompany that and are confirmed by God. I think it's interesting, even outside of the Bible, a couple of historical reference. Josephus writes about this proselytizing practice. They also made proselytes of a great many of the Greeks perpetually, and thereby after a sort brought them to be a portion of their own body. And with him quoting a man named Strabo, it is hard to find a place in the habitable earth that is not admitted this tribe of men and is not possessed by them. So it's clear as we approach this topic of the Judaizing teachers that there was a lot of evangelizing going on in the first century, and kind of out of this, as people are converted, you're going to see some people continuing that practice, even within the church. So we're going to turn our minds right now to the book of Galatians, and try to first just establish who are these people, where do they come from, and what are they actually teaching? The first time I think we see them is at the end of Acts 13, which is, these aren't Judaizers proper, but the reaction that they get when Paul turns to the Gentiles after the Jews reject the gospel in Antioch. It says, the next Sabbath, nearly the whole city assembled to hear the word of the Lord. But when the Jews saw the crowds, they were filled with jealousy and began contradicting the things spoken by Paul and were blaspheming. So you have kind of the initial bad reaction from the Jews. These Gentiles, they shouldn't be allowed in, and so they're contradicting Paul, speaking against him. Of course, Acts 15 is one of the main places we find this. And I'm just going to put this list up here real quick. It's interesting, this isn't the full list, but there are a lot of places in the New Testament that you find, even if it's not directly going against the Judaizing teachers, there's a lot of teachings that Paul sprinkles through his writings that kind of help fortify the Christians he's writing to be able to watch out for this. It comes up in Romans, it comes up in 1 Corinthians, you know, circumcision and uncircumcision doesn't matter. In Ephesians, we were talking about this in our young adult class this morning, he abolished the law of commandments, it's not important whether circumcised and uncircumcised are one body. We'll talk a little more in a moment about these passages. The ones that are underlined are the ones that are most direct, dealing with the Judaizing teachers themselves. But it's just interesting to see how much this comes up in the New Testament. So in Acts 15 and verse 5, I think we have the first direct mention of these people and really a definition of what they were teaching. Acts 15, it says, "But some believers who belonged to the party of the Pharisees rose up and said, 'It is necessary to circumcise them,'" that is, the Gentiles, "'and to order them to keep the law of Moses.'" So right there you have believers. These are Christians who have been converted to Jesus, baptized for the forgiveness of their sins. They're within the church. But they believe that these Gentiles can't come in until what happens? Basically, they become Jews. So they would be Judaizing teachers. And of course, what we see happening later on in Galatians is just that. The things that Paul is worried about in Galatians chapter 4, verse 10. "You observe days and months and seasons and years," I think referencing the Jewish feasts and things like that. Galatians 5 and verse 3. "I testify again to every man who receives circumcision that he is under obligation to keep the whole law." That's exactly what the Judaizers wanted to happen. Circumcise them and to tell them to keep the law of Moses. It's interesting that in Acts 15 and verse 24, this is an excerpt from that letter. You remember after the council in Jerusalem, they send this letter up to Antioch. And in that letter, he says, "Some of our number, or some from us, to whom we gave no instruction, have disturbed you with their words, unsettling your souls." And we see that same term used twice in the book of Galatians. In Galatians 1 and verse 7, "There are some who are disturbing you." And in Galatians 5 and verse 12, "I wish that those who are troubling you," it's the same Greek word, and wishes some very nasty things upon them. But the idea here is that the Judaizers wanted to come into a group of Christians and convince the Gentile converts who had not been circumcised and were not practicing Judaism that they were lost. It'd be pretty disturbing. And if the Judaizers were right, that's something that would have needed to happen. If I was to go in and study with a group of Mormons, you know, I wouldn't go in there trying to convince them that, hey, we're all on the same page, we all believe in the same Lord and everything. No, like, I would be trying to, in a sense, disturb them and trying to show them, hey, there's another way here that's right. But the thing is here is these people were coming into the midst of a healthy congregation that was doing what was right in a lot of ways and disturbing these Christians and making them think that they weren't saved when in fact they were. Serious spiritual problems they're causing. In Galatians 2 and verse 4, it talks about them in these terms. "False brethren secretly brought in who had sneaked in to spy out our liberty, which we have in Christ Jesus." In Philippians 3 and verse 2, it talks of them in these terms. "Beware of the dogs, beware of the evil workers, beware of the mutilation," your version might say, "false circumcision," or those who mutilate the flesh. I think it's the Gentile perspective on circumcision, basically, is what he's talking about in warning against them. So this is who these people are, but what were their motives? And this is really where I think we get to the heart of our lesson tonight, as we start to think about, why would these teachers be doing what they were doing when there was a lot of evidence to the contrary? What would really make anybody depart from the truth and then try to convert other people to their point of view when they're in error? So we're going to look at these things together. In Acts 13, verse 44 and 45, we already read this verse, when they saw the crowds going to Paul, what were they filled with? Jealousy. And isn't that one of the primary things that the Jews initially were so worried about, even during the ministry of Jesus? Pilate recognized that they had handed him over because of envy, right? Envy, jealousy. The Jews wanted the attention that they had been getting all these years, and now they're saying, wait, you can do away with that? You don't have to be circumcised and keep the law of Moses? What is this? And so wanting that control, they're jealous when they see Paul converting these Gentiles. So that's one of the reasons they're doing this. In Galatians 2 and verse 4, it mentions that one of the reasons they did this was so that they might bring us into slavery. In Colossians chapter 2, there's some question as to whether all of the section in Colossians 2 is directly talking about Judaizers, but I think some of it for sure is. But in that section it says, see that no one takes you captive. And isn't that really one of the things that false teaching can accomplish? Is that once it's planted, once someone has these ideas in their mind, they're kind of locked in to this new system. And there's an influence and a control that a false teacher can exercise over a group of people that they've convinced otherwise. So I think one of the motives they may well have had is the desire to control other people and not to bring them into subjection to the Lord so much as bring them into subjection to themselves. In Galatians 6 and verse 12, it says, those who desire to make a good showing in the flesh try to compel you to be circumcised. In Philippians 3 and verse 3, when Paul is kind of contrasting what the Judaizing teachers were teaching, he says, we put no confidence in the flesh. But I think the idea is the others were putting that confidence in the flesh. So this idea of just pridefulness, of wanting to look good on the outside, of wanting to be able to boast in the number of converts that you've made, in wanting people to look at you and say, look at how influential they are and the number of people that they brought in. Again, it's this self-focus of not so much wanting to convert people to the Lord, but converting them to your way of doing things. And that's a real danger that we can have, brethren, sometimes. We have to be so careful to distinguish between what's really the will of the Lord and what's just the way that we've kind of always done things or the way we want things to go, and to make sure that we're not acting pridefully in that and just trying to convert people to our way as opposed to converting them to the Lord's way as we ourselves are converted to that. In Galatians 6 and verse 12, the rest of that verse says, simply so that they will not be persecuted for the cross of Christ. And certainly fear is one of the things that's going to enter into the equation here. And especially when you look at what was happening in the first century, if you, especially as a Jew, decided to let the Gentiles in without telling them to accept these extra requirements, how are your Jewish brethren going to view that? It did not go well for those who chose to go against the established pattern all through the Old Testament. This was a new thing. I mean, I think even Peter himself needed a lot of convincing. And that's why God gives him all these different signs to say, hey, the Gentiles are in. They don't have to be circumcised and keep the law to be saved. And so there's times where fear enters into that, both fear of what's going to happen and fear from other people. He says that one of the reasons they were doing this is so they wouldn't be persecuted for the cross of Christ. In the very next verse, it says, they desire to have you circumcised so that they may boast in your flesh. And again, similar to the idea of the pride that we've already mentioned, is this the idea of attention? That these Jews wanted to come back. I think the idea is like, you know, when that group goes up to Antioch from Jerusalem in Acts 15, is they want to come back to Jerusalem and be able to say, hey, we got all these Gentiles, you know, converted to Judaism. We set them straight. You know, we accomplished this great thing and wanted the attention that would come from that. And in Philippians 3:9, as Paul, again, kind of talking in contrast to the Judaizing teachers, he says, not having a righteousness of my own derived from the law. And that was one of the biggest things, wasn't it, with the Judaizing teachers, with the Pharisees, is that they were self-righteous. They weren't so much worried about people being right with the Lord, but they wanted to justify themselves and put other people down. You see that in the Pharisee and the tax collector and some of the parables Jesus taught. But I want you to take just a second and look at the list right there of some of these motives that these men have. Where in the book of Galatians do you kind of see a list of things like this? In Galatians chapter 5, you have two lists. We talked about some of those this morning, if you remember. We were talking about the good part of that this morning and the fruits of the Spirit. But before the fruits of the Spirit, you have basically the works of the flesh. And if you remember anything from the lesson tonight, I want you to think about this, is that so much of false teaching and the work of false teachers goes back to the works of the flesh. It goes back to envy and jealousy and strife and dissension and wrath and all these things. And it's so sad to see it, but so many times it's not just the doctrinal things, but it's the fact that there's other motivations that when Satan gets into our hearts, when we abandon the fruits of the Spirit, we can go in all sorts of different wrong directions. But it starts with our hearts. And that's really, I think, at the heart of Galatians, is God wants to get the works of the flesh out and get the fruit of the Spirit in. So even with whatever technical, doctrinal things you might say, at the heart of these things is the works of the flesh. As we think about the methods that the Judaizing teachers use to get people on their side, we're going to see more of the works of the flesh in this. In Galatians chapter 2 and verse 4, the first thing that we see about them is that they weren't up front. We don't know a lot of details about how they would have kind of infiltrated the church there, how they got in, but it's that they were false brethren, secretly brought in, sneaked in to spy out our freedom that we have in Christ. In Colossians 2 and verse 4, it describes these false teachers as those who delude you with persuasive arguments. It's not that they weren't influential people, but they weren't being forthright. They were being persuasive, but there are some things that just weren't up front. And so dishonesty is one of the primary methods that sometimes you'll see. And one of the things that scares me is when I see this in people that I know, is you talk with them and you can tell, like, you don't even really know what they believe about this or that. And sometimes there's kind of this intentional shielding of what all they believe so that they can persuade you and then get you to believe whatever it is. And we need to remember that the truth has nothing to fear. If you are coming to somebody to try to convince them of the truth, you tell them what you believe. You say, here's why I believe what I believe in the Word. And brethren, we need to be the kind of people who are willing to be open with one another about what we believe and why we believe it. Because when we start to get into secrecy and shielding things here and there, it's easy for us to get way off. One of the other things in chapter 4, verse 16, and this I think might be the saddest one to me as far as seeing their methods, is when bitterness creeps in, Satan can divide even the closest of friends. Proverbs talks about the whisperer, you know, separating even the closest of friends. And I think that's really what we see the Judaizers doing among the Christians of Galatia. And really, they did it first and foremost with Paul, because Paul was the one most promoting this idea of, hey, the Gentiles are in. They're okay. You don't have to keep the law of Moses. And so Paul says, have I become your enemy by telling you the truth? Now, if you think about that, how would that happen? I think one of the root things that happens here is the idea of bitterness getting in, of these false teachers coming in and saying things about Paul and attacking his character and attacking his methods and getting these people to try to treat Paul as their enemy when Paul was telling them the truth. And you see what's happened there? It's like, why would you consider someone your enemy when they're telling you the truth?
And the answer is, when you get the works of the flesh in there, it shuts down the mind. Satan wants to get us to a point where we're no longer willing to openly discuss the truth and really reason with people. He wants us to just shut down and say, well, I don't respect them anymore. They've done me wrong, and I'm not going to listen to them, even if what they're saying is right. Bitterness can shut down the mind. And once you stop thinking and reasoning from the Scriptures, again, there's no telling what false doctrine may come in there, but at its root, bitterness is so many times the wedge that makes people enemies and gets people away from the truth and unwilling to listen to the truth. In the very next verse, in Galatians 4 and verse 17, he says, "They eagerly seek you, not commendably, but they wish to shut you out so that you will seek them." And isn't it interesting just the way human nature works is we're social creatures. We want to be accepted by the people that are around us, don't we? And you can think back to, you know, times even in like middle school or whatever where there's like the kids that form the secret club, right? And, you know, they've got the secret handshake and you have to go through the initiation or whatever to be in. And what's the goal of that? They've got the cool thing so that they can do what to everybody else? Shut them out. And when you're on the outside of that, how do you feel? Oh man, like, I want to be in there. And so you seek them to try to get on the inside. And that's one of the effective methods that the false teachers here were using to get people to want in. It's, hey, you can't really be a Christian unless you're a Jew, unless you keep the time-honored traditions handed down by God through Moses, right? There would have been a lot of persuasive arguments the Judaizers could have used, but the idea is they went in there to make these Gentile Christians feel like they were missing out. They were on the outside looking in, and so they would then seek the Judaizers and learn from them. And again, I think we just see the pride of the Judaizers in this. They're the ones that you have to go through. They're the ones who you have to listen to in order to really be saved. Not just the stuff that Paul's teaching, but you got to come through guys like us. And again, just these things, dishonesty, bitterness, pride, there's still so much at work. As you look at this, this is kind of the anatomy of so much false teaching, even that doesn't have anything to do with Judaism. In chapter 5 and verse 11, I think we see kind of a reflective argument where Paul says, if I then still preach circumcision, why am I still being persecuted? It may be that the Judaizers were trying to basically reflect on Paul. Well, Paul himself teaches this anyway. And Paul, of course, has to shoot this down and saying, then why am I still being persecuted? There's no water. That argument can't hold any water. In Acts 21, we see something similar. When Paul returns to Jerusalem, the Jews there tell him, hey, what's the story going around about Paul? Is that he is preventing the Jews from being circumcised. He's preaching against Jews being circumcised, which Paul does not do that. And so Paul goes through the necessary methods to counteract that and say, no, that's not what I'm saying, that's not what I'm teaching. But when rumors like this start going around, what do you have? You got confusion. And this is one of the things that I think gets so many people today, is there's so many churches, there's so much going on, I'm just confused, and there just must not really be a truth. And that's one of the things that false teachers can do, is they just start throwing dust in the air, they start telling rumors, they start doing all sorts of different things to try to get people distracted from the truth. If they can just attack the character of somebody, if they can just get some enough things on the board that people are like, well, I don't even know what's true anymore, then they can, it's more easily implement their teaching. And finally, in Colossians 2 and verse 8, see that no one takes you captive according to the tradition of men. So one of the things the Judaizers would have had on their side is the hundreds of years of influence coming in. And sometimes that's the way that false teachers appeal, is look at all of the people who are following this. Look at all of the people who are going with me and are on my side in this. And we just know that the majority is not always right. And we need to be willing to enter through the narrow gate, as Jesus mentions. One of the things that we see here is just in these, specifically these three things, dishonesty, bitterness, and pride, is again, this is a battle for the heart. If the false teachers can plant the bitterness in there, if they can get you thinking the wrong things, believing the wrong things, and then if they can make you part of their special club and make you think that you're better than those people out there, those are, brethren, those are just some of the things that I've seen friends of mine who have gone through this process. And especially the bitterness and pride. If there were two things that I could single out of people that I've seen go off into false movements, those have been the two things that have got me. And we've got to guard our hearts and do our best to fight for the hearts of those around us. Because again, it's not always in the particulars. It's really in the heart that the battle is won or lost. So as we think about how Paul reacted to these people, we're going to go fairly quickly through this list this evening. But I think it's important to note how Paul deals with these things and think about how we can work through these things. I will note that as we go through this list, Paul is not so much reacting to the false teachers themselves in the book of Galatians, but he's reacting more toward the people who've been affected and kind of poisoned and embittered by the false teachers. How he reaches out to them. It's interesting in Galatians chapter 2, when Paul makes that visit to Jerusalem, whichever visit you believe that that is, the reason Paul made that visit was to make sure that he had not run in vain. And I think that's commendable to see with Paul, is that even as he's teaching this, he wants to check himself first. And so many times when we're dealing with false teaching, our first reaction is to jump down somebody's throat and not check ourselves. But I think we see Paul in the book of Galatians modeling that idea of make sure it's not the plank in your eye before getting the speck out of your brother's eye. As Paul makes sure and checks these things with the brethren in Jerusalem to make sure he hadn't run in vain. In Galatians chapter 2, 11 through 14, he does not compromise even when Peter and Barnabas are acting hypocritically. Paul is willing to publicly and confrontationally oppose those who are promoting this false doctrine. And that's one thing that we have to be willing and ready to do. There's wisdom that is required with that. But Paul's willing to have the hard conversations and to do it in a public way if that is what is necessary. It's interesting that Paul himself makes sure to act consistently. In Galatians 4 and verse 12, he says, "I have become as you are." And I think the idea there is that Paul had not been living just as a Jew. He wasn't distancing himself from the Gentiles. So Paul had acted consistently, but what did Peter do in Galatians 2, when the men came from James? Peter didn't act consistently. So Paul, by his own actions, acted consistently and called out Peter when he didn't. In Galatians 3, we're not going to cover this text at all tonight, is that so much of Galatians is just trying to point them away from the idea of being justified by law. And I think that's one of the reasons he talks so much about that in the book, is he's trying to point them to the correct way of salvation by faith in the Lord. In Galatians chapter 4, verses 8 through 20, I want us to look at this text for just a moment, because I think this is where you just see Paul's heart in trying to reach out to these brethren. In Galatians 4, verses 8 through 11, he calls them to remember their own conversion. He says, "However, at that time, when you did not know God, you were slaves to those which by nature are no gods. But now that you have come to know God, or rather to be known by God, how is it that you turn back again to the weak and worthless elemental things to which you desire to be enslaved all over again? You observe days and months and seasons and years. I fear for you that perhaps I have labored over you in vain." These Gentile Christians had fought to come out of idolatry. What's kind of amazing about this is that Paul uses language here that almost equates Judaism with going back into idolatry and calling these like the elemental things of the world, the weak and worthless elemental things, to be enslaved all over again. They came out of slavery just to be tricked back into slavery. Don't do this. And Paul is fearful for them. He cares about them. And you can just feel his heart as you read this. In verses 12 through 15, he says, "I beg of you, brethren, become as I am, for I also have become as you are. You've done me no wrong, but you know that it was because of a bodily illness that I preached the gospel to you the first time. And that which was a trial to you in my bodily condition, you did not despise or loathe, but you received me as an angel of God, as Christ Jesus himself. Where then is that sense of blessing you had? For I bear you witness that, if possible, you would have plucked out your eyes and given them to me. Whatever Paul's physical infirmity was, Paul, again, appeals to these brethren and saying, remember the relationship we used to have? And then the very next verse, have I now become your enemy? By telling you the truth. It's important that we have that relationship with one another, brethren. So that if we are being pulled apart by error and different things, that we can appeal and say, do you remember the way we were together? Remember the way you received me before? In 16 through 18. So have I become your enemy by telling you the truth? They eagerly seek you, not commendably, but they wish to shut you out so that you will seek them. But it is good always to be eagerly sought in a commendable manner, and not only when I am present with you. My children, with whom I am again in labor until Christ is formed in you. But I could wish to be present with you now and to change my tone, for I am perplexed about you. Paul just pours his heart out to these people. And he says, look at the motives of the people who are seeking you. He looks at his own motives and then looks at their motives and says, they're not doing this in a commendable way. They're in it for themselves. Look at how much you mean to me. It's like I am in labor until Christ is formed in you. Paul's own anguish was for the salvation of his hearers. And in chapter 5, Paul is willing to tell these brethren in no uncertain terms what would happen if they stayed on that path of error. In Galatians chapter 5, beginning in verse 2, he says, behold, I, Paul, say to you that if you receive circumcision, Christ will be of no benefit to you. And I testify again to every man who receives circumcision that he is under obligation to keep the whole law. You have been severed from Christ. You who are seeking to be justified by the law, you have fallen from grace. Some of the strongest words in the New Testament as far as telling people you are lost if you stay on this path. Paul loves these brethren. And so he tells them what they need to hear about the consequences of the path that they're on. In verses 5 and 6, though he points to the positive end of things, he says, for we through the Spirit by faith are waiting for the hope of righteousness. For in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision means anything, but faith working through love. And this is some of the point that Paul makes in 1 Corinthians 7 and some of the other passages, is that it doesn't matter. We can be united in Jesus Christ and in the Spirit without this question of circumcision. That's not the deciding factor in your salvation. In verse 7, he says, you were running well. Who hindered you from obeying the truth? This persuasion did not come from him who calls you. A little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough. I have confidence in you in the Lord that you will adopt no other view, but the one who is disturbing you will bear his judgment, whoever he is. But I, brethren, if I still preach circumcision, why am I still persecuted? Then the stumbling block of the cross has been abolished. I wish that those who are troubling you would even mutilate themselves. In this verse, Paul expresses confidence in these brethren, that he thinks they really will do well. After listening to him and responding to this letter, that they will choose the right path. And I think this one thing that is so commendable about what Paul does, like when he writes to Philemon about the sticky situation he was in and Onesimus coming back to him, he says, I know that you're going to do even more than I say. And that's an appealing thing when we're trying to work with people, is to have confidence in the Lord in them. I like the way that Paul says that there in verse 10. I have confidence in you in the Lord that you will adopt no other view. That's a helpful thing when we can have that confidence in one another that we'll do the right thing. He corrects the false accusations with proof. Again, I'm still being persecuted. I couldn't still be preaching circumcision. Otherwise, why are the Jews still after me? And ultimately, in chapter 6, Paul brings this all back around to the cross of Jesus Christ. After contrasting this to the people being forcing them to be circumcised, they don't keep the law themselves. They desire to have you circumcised so that they may boast in your flesh, verses we've already talked about. Galatians 6 and verse 14. But may it never be that I would boast except in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, through which the world has been crucified to me and I to the world. Paul brings this back to the cross. Because, brethren, when we're dealing with different doctrinal things and we're confused and there's bitterness and there's hurt, if we can bring ourselves back to the foot of the cross, we can work through whatever disagreements or error that might be in our hearts. Because it's at the foot of the cross that we lay down all of our pride. Paul ironically says the only thing that we can boast in is what? Not something that we did, but something that was done in spite of us. And something that we did not deserve. That is our boasting. And when we lay down our pride, we'll be willing to listen to each other. We'll be willing to examine the Scriptures. And we'll ultimately be able to come around to the truth by sticking with those things. Some applications and misapplications, just briefly as we draw the lesson to a close. There are, of course, the misapplications even today. There are those who still teach that you need to keep the law of Moses and to be circumcised in order to be saved. You may have heard of the Hebrew Roots movement or the Messianic Jews and other groups like them that still teach the law of Moses. They're essentially modern-day Judaizers. This is not a dead movement, but there are still those who say you have to keep the law of Moses in order to be saved. Another interesting misapplication of this context, I ran across this on gotquestions.org, which is kind of a Calvinistic-leaning religious website, and it says this about in their entry on the Judaizers. In the early church, those who taught a combination of God's grace and human effort were called Judaizers. Do you see what happened there? It was true that the Judaizers were leaning on works of the law, but they suddenly took that specific application to Judaism and went, and are saying, any human effort in response to those things is Judaizing. And so they would define us as Judaizers, basically. If you say you need to be baptized for the remission of sins, that's human effort. That's a work of the law, you know. And again, we don't have time to go into all that, but that's a misapplication of some of these principles that you'll see sometimes. But some of the applications for us that I think really we've already made this evening. And that is just, first of all, the danger of adding anything of our own to the gospel. At the beginning of the book of Galatians, that passage we often quote that says, you know, if anybody brings to you a different gospel, he is to be accursed, anathema. That's the Judaizers here. And they were teaching Jesus. They were teaching baptism for the remission of sins. As far as I can tell, they were teaching all of those things, but what had they done? They had added the Jewish system onto that. The gospel plus anything else is not the gospel. As you've already seen, I just think the heart of false teaching goes back to that passage in Galatians 5, the works of the flesh and the fruit of the Spirit. And as we work to maintain the truth, and as we work through doctrinal questions, we need to work equally hard to keep an open heart. Because, brethren, if we can work on our hearts and have the fruit of the Spirit being born in our life, we'll be able to work through those things as they come up and maintain the unity God wants us to have. Again, in Galatians 3 and 4 and 5, I just think it's so valuable to see that Paul takes multiple approaches in trying to get these men back to him. He takes the technical approach. He uses even the law itself, the Old Testament, to show them this is no longer the system you're under. But Paul also appeals to their hearts. He says, remember the times that we were together. Remember the way that our relationship has worked. Paul is willing to use whatever methods to get these people back and to win their hearts back. And it's ultimately the power to unite us in the truth is the power of the cross. It will keep us humble. It will keep us putting one another before ourselves and making whatever sacrifices we have to make in order to maintain and fight for the truth. I hope this lesson has been helpful to us tonight. And really, it's the call of the cross that is the gospel invitation. In just a minute, we'll sing a song. And those who need to make their lives right with the Lord have the opportunity to do that. And this is an invitation for everybody. It's not just for people who haven't become Christians yet. But it's always valuable during this time for all of us to examine ourselves and to think about if some of these things, some of the works of the flesh, have gotten into our life, if we've gotten off into different things. But if you need to become a Christian this evening, you don't have to keep the law of Moses. Good news. But the call of the Lord is through Jesus Christ, through faith in Him, submitting to Him, naming Him as your Lord, being baptized into Him, Him alone. And if you're here this evening and you just need prayers, if you need the help of the brethren here, if there's any way we can be useful to you, please let us know that by coming to the front while we stand and sing this song.